One thing more. Glamorous is my friend, and I will not dissociate myself from his disgrace. I now lay down the command of my legions and retire to private life.
Goodbye, Crassus.
I suggest this is no time for a man of honor to withdraw from public affairs.
This sort of heroic public behavior is nothing. You have seen it before, we all have, and I know the meaning of it.
Crassus acted on a point of honor.
Patrician honor. No matter how noble this looks on the outside, I don't like the color of it.
Crassus is the only man in Rome who hasn't yielded to Republican corruption, and never will.
I'll take a little Republican corruption along with a little Republican freedom, but I won't take the dictatorship of Crassus.
President Joe Biden is talking about unity. At the same time, his somewhat fragile coalition, big tech, big business, big government, and the hard, angry left are busy either censoring or suppressing dissident views. We'll talk about all this, about freedom of expression and what happened to the civil libertarians that I remember on the Democratic side with Tom Bevin, co-founder of RealClearPolitics.com, one of my favorite news sites where you can go and get all sorts of opinion from the left and the right. And make your own decisions, like Americans used to. Tom Bevin, former cornerback or quarterback from Princeton University, is also going to be asked about Patrick Mahomes and his athletic exploits. Jeff Carlin is here, executive producer, as always, of WGN Radio. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune and a member of its editorial board. And where are you? As one side tells you to shut up and the other side screams a little too much and there's fear and threats of violence in the air and instability, which some are afraid of and others call freedom. You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun, he sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
Big tech, big government, the hard left, and the establishment seek to silence conservative voices and throw the flayed hides of conservative dissenters upon the funeral pyre of unity and free speech. I can't think of a better way to introduce our next guest, Tom Bevin, co-founder of RealClearPolitics.com, the site I go to every morning to learn all sorts of things from the left and the right. And I noticed right after I'd written a column on asking about where are the Democrats and free speech, I quoted Glenn Greenwald. And of course, I see that article. Tom had selected that article on the front page of his website because he goes left, right, and center, kind of like how newspapers used to be. Good morning. Good day, Mr. Bevan.
Good morning. That was a very dramatic intro there with the Game of Thrones imagery. It was quite...
I thought it was rather Homeric, actually. All right. Before we get into the, you know, your... before we get into the great Tom Bevan's athletic exploits at Princeton.
Oh, geez.
And as a quarterback and deciding whether or not Patrick Mahomes should have played on Sunday. Well, let's ask you. I know this is, well, most people will see this after the game, but we're talking before the game. So should he play or not?
I mean, if the doctors clear him and he wants to, sure. I mean, I don't think that's a decision for the Kansas City Times editorial board or Kansas City Star editorial board or anybody else for that matter. Yeah, I mean, it's up to him. And he's a grown man. You know, he gets paid an awful lot of money to go to work. And if he feels like he's ready to go to work and can, and the doctors say that he can, it's up to him.
This is not the old days when Tom Bevan and John Cass played at playing football. This is the new day of.
Yeah, and look, rightfully so. I think you know, there's a new emphasis on health because of all we've learned about traumatic brain injury and all that. I mean, yeah, back in my day, it was like, you know, I would have been sent back in that game like three plays later. You know,
it's
like,
put some dirt on it. Rub some dirt
right,
on it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, there's no going into the blue tent or the locker room or any of that. You sit on the bench, and when you can go back in, you go back in. So, but it's not like that anymore, and that's understandable and laudable, I think, in some ways. And so it's his decision and the doctors.
I just want everybody to equate the National Football League with Anthony Quinn in No Requiem for a Heavyweight. Okay. But that's just me as a proponent of soccer, which also leads to concussions. And
yeah,
indeed.
Jeff is the former keeper of the Celtic FC. That's and right. Palatine understands that.
Keeper and sweeper.
Keeper and sweeper, just like a Brazilian. So, Tom, I guess people want to know what's your take on this whole business of Biden calling for unity while at the same time ramping up, as Greenwald and others, including John Cass, have said, a shutdown of dissident thought. How does that work out?
Well, I mean, we'll see. I think his speech was fine. I mean, I've seen some hyperventilating. Chris Wallace called it the greatest inauguration speech he'd ever seen, going all the way back to 1961. I saw some people, you know, saying, well, it wasn't quite Lincoln's second inaugural, but that's where it wanted to be. And I mean, just like, it was fine. Okay. It was a decent speech, right, particularly for him, who's not a, you know, sort of a rousing orator. So I thought he met the moment, he said the right words. And, you know, I saw some criticism as well that he could have gone further. He could have said more. And there was this dichotomy which said, I want unity and whatever. And we also have to, you know, do away with the scourge of white supremacy and all of these things. And it was kind of, the implication was, look, I want unity as long as we're all doing what I want you to do. And we're all going in my direction. So the proof will be in the pudding, in the actions and what he does, particularly on the legislative front. These executive orders, they are what they are. And this is an unfortunate part of our current political landscape, is that everybody rushes in there, you know, and it really, I mean, Obama started, you know, my phone and my pen, and I'm going to make all these, I can't get it through Congress, so I'm going to do these executive orders. So Trump did the same thing. Now Biden's doing the same thing times 10. And you can bet that when a Republican gets back into that office, they will sit down with their own stack of executive orders and try and undo as much of President Biden's, you know, agenda as possible. So that kind of is what it is. The question is, so legislatively, you know, what are Democrats going to do when they look at this COVID bill and they get resistance from Republicans in the Senate. Do they compromise and strip out some of the bailouts for states and cities? Do they go just down to a direct payment to businesses, small businesses and individuals, which is what the Republicans want? Or do they decide to use, you know, budget reconciliation to just put Republicans in the seat and get 51 votes and jam it through? And what are they going to do with Biden's next top priority, which is immigration reform, which definitely won't get Republican support in the Senate to reach the 60 vote threshold? Do they decide to try and compromise to bring Republicans on board? Will Biden negotiate that? Or will they go the route of sort of political brute force and blow up the legislative filibuster and jam it through with 51 votes? So I think we're gonna see how this works out, and a lot of it will be, you know, how does Joe Biden, how does he act? What does he do? What does his administration do in terms of dealing with Republicans? And that's going to tell you a lot about where we're headed.
How will Nancy Pelosi play it, since she's got a thin, razor thin majority in the House? The election, we always have a next election, and there's always a next election, and there will be one in 2 years. And if this is her last term, how is she going to fend off the hard left, even though she is of the left as well, fend off the AOCs and all that on immigration?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, Bill Clinton came in as a new Democrat, and the first thing he did was, you know, gaze in the military and some other social related gun control. And that really, I think, undermined his political standing and cost him in the midterm elections, right? George W. Bush had the Iraq War, you know, 9/11, that was sort of a historical anomaly. But the question is, what does Joe Biden do? I think there's widespread support, bipartisan support for attacking the virus and vaccine distribution and all of that. You know, on other issues, I think he has to be careful, because I'm not sure how much widespread support there is for reducing a path to citizenship from 13 years to 8 years for 11 million people who are here illegally, and, you know, combined with stopping the border wall and all that stuff. That could be one of those issues that is, you know, creates some backlash that could have consequences for Democrats in the Congress in 2022. So we will have to wait and see. But I do think, both in the House and the Senate, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are going to have their hands full trying to manage the competing interests of their caucus. As you mentioned, you've got the sort of radical progressives, the squads, they want it all. And then you've got the more centrists, the Joe Manchins of the world, who are not going to be going along with, at least we don't think will be going along with, things like, you know, packing the Supreme Court and statehood for D.C. and Puerto Rico and some of the more you know, left wing parts of the Democratic agenda.
Tom, I'm sad to report to you that the Chicago Way podcast is now engaged in a Twitter war.
Oh no!
Yes, in which Jeff Carlin, my friend, is being attacked as Pie Boy.
Oh, John.
What is that about, Jeff? This is just a way to get Jeff in.
Because, I know, yeah. Right? I know. Right. Yeah, in Twitter war, I don't know. I don't engage in war. So
Twitter spat.
Yeah. There was a gentleman on who's a local Chicago taxpayer, or Illinois taxpayer, who took umbrage with me being predictably leftist, apparently. And I responded to his tweet with kindness and fun, because I don't need to get into a spat with anybody. I rated his well thought out tweet and gave it a score. I had to deduct some points because of a misspelling, but that's all that bothers me. I don't care.
Well, I was going to retweet something Tom Bevin retweeted about someone in Chicago demanding that I be deplatformed, because, you know, that's the left. The left. And a publication that is really used for lining the shoes of homeless people, I think, when it was printed. and now they're demanding I get silenced again.
But it's unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, it really is. If we want to broach this subject, I mean, the movement to suppress thoughts and opinions of, you know, conservatives, Republicans, whatever, Now, listen, I get the idea, and it's not an easy thing for platforms like Facebook and Twitter. They do not want to be promoting stuff that encourages violence. And, you know, if people are calling, I mean, there was some nasty, nasty stuff on Facebook, right? Of the Facebook Live, you know, they're live streaming, you know, criminal acts of abuse and all sorts of stuff. I mean,
right.
So I get that.
No one supports that. No one in their right mind supports violence or hate.
Right. And so those platforms, first of all, they're private companies, so they're within their rights to do whatever they want, and particularly within their rights to do that. But, you know, it is a narrow, thin line and a slippery slope to go from that to saying, you know, we're going to label these tweets that are differences of opinion or whatever, these thoughts as lies or incorrect, or we're going to censor people, we're going to shut them down, we're going to turn off their accounts. And I feel like the Democrats in particular have been for some time cheering this on. They have been demanding that Facebook and Twitter shut down the president's account. They've been demanding that, you know, all of these folks are silenced and removed and deplatformed and all that stuff. And that is very disturbing to me. And I'm not alone. I mean, a lot of Americans, I think it's an unwelcome development of, you know, of folks, particularly on the left. Let's be clear about that right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you know, for it's funny because both sides are screaming the other side is fascist, right? It's like, you know, Trump supporters are fascists.
Meanwhile,
you're right. I mean, maybe we are all fascists, every one of us. But certainly, you know, the folks who are screaming that Republicans or Trump supporters are fascists are being fascists themselves in trying to, you know, shut down and not only that, but I mean, literally prosecute their political enemies. It's not a good look. As I said, it's not a welcome development. And I don't know where it goes from here. I don't know how we back off it.
We had Charles Lipson on last week, who's a frequent contributor to Real Clear Politics and other
indeed
sites. And Charles comes from a tradition of the civil libertarian as a professor, always allowing for and encouraging diversity of thought and intellectual combat, as do you, Tom Bevin, because as evidence, all you have to do is go to realclearpolitics.com and you'll see on its front page punditry and opinion and analysis from the left and the right. Often it goes in order like left, right, or vice versa. But I wonder what happened to the general sense that that we grew up with from our professors, from our editors, from our teachers in school, to support the idea of freedom of expression, freedom of thought. When did the civil libertarians, sorry to quote myself, but when did the Democrats lose the civil libertarians?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And I think it's been taking place. There are just different aspects to this, right? There's the shift in the culture that's taken place in the schools and academia and newsrooms that has been going on for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of sort of the woke crowd, young woke crowd getting in there and reshaping those institutions. And certainly, you know, on college campuses, the professors have been sort of, many of the professors have been sort of leading that charge for some time. But there's a different, you know, Carl Cannon and I talk about this a lot. And there was, you know, especially for a long time, the ACLU was sort of a non-political. I mean, they would defend free speech rights of anyone, folks on
literal
the left
Nazis.
And the right.
Literal Nazis.
Literal Nazis who marched in Skokie. Can you imagine right. The ACLU standing up for the right of Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois today? I mean, It's inconceivable that that would happen.
Yeah.
I looked at their website, and free speech, etc., is like number 10 on their list.
Yeah, it's gone. They have, and that happened is a more recent thing, as in like during the Trump years, they sort of abandoned the idea that they were going to be defenders of free speech for all and decided to be defenders of free speech for some. And that is also an unwelcome development. And so I think there has been an erosion of folks who are defending free speech. And part of that is, you know, this idea that there's this woke mentality, which is, it's tough to resist. I mean, it really is. I'll give you one example, and I haven't spoken about this before, and I hope it doesn't get me in trouble. But I live in Evanston. It is a very liberal neighborhood. We have a very woke president, superintendent of our schools, public schools. And one of the parents, and this is all, if you search local news, you'll find this. It's on the, you know, Evanston Patch and Evanston Roundtable and all that. But one of the parents wrote an email to him and said, look, I'm really disappointed in the lack of leadership of the Evanston, you know, District 65 school board. You know, it's been a year that we've been out of school. The kids have been online, and you're just now putting together an advisory board. And, you know, why are you telling us all this information? You're presenting it as new when it's in fact, we've known this stuff for months. And you know, I'm really disappointed in the lack of leadership. And his response, which started off fine, which was like, look, I take full responsibility. I'm responsible for the safety of all the students and administrators. And then so that was all fine. And then he concluded with this. He said, in the world that we live in, I'm sure that you have not had to reflect on your white supremacist thinking and way of life. White supremacy is no longer the white hooded villain attempting to cause physical harm. You make personal attacks toward me because we are not giving you what you want. I suggest you look in the mirror and reflect on who you are and how you're presenting yourself to an African-American leader. I refuse to sit back and be assaulted about my decision making to not return to in-person learning, especially when the undertone is outright racism.
Oh my God.
And so you can see why it's difficult to challenge. I mean, any criticism is responded to with this idea that, you know, you can't criticize me because of the color of my skin or the color of your skin. Even on issues where race is not, you know, that race was never raised as an issue.
Was the parent black? That would have been delicious if the parent was.
I'm pretty sure not. And they have, you know, they know who the email was sent from. They know they have, you know, kids in the school district. So right. I think I'd be shocked if they didn't look that up before he made that statement. But I think the broader point is, and this is, I mean, listen, I've lived in Evanston for 20 years. It is the most progressive community maybe in the country. I mean, the white people who live here are not racist. In fact, they are social justice warriors. Many, or not most of them, are all fully on board with all of the progressive stuff that is going on here. And so it's just ironic that, like, even in the most progressive communities, even with the most progressive white folks, that they are, you know, any criticism, you are attacked as being a white supremacist. And so it is, you know, I'm sure this person learned their lesson, and you know, it's hard for people to speak up, and in an environment where doing so may cost you your reputation, your livelihood, your standing in the community. I mean, it is so oppressive, and it makes it. It makes free speech just an absolute casualty. And that's in some ways understandable. It's working as the proponents intended to work, right? It shuts down any discussion about anything because you say, well, you're a white supremacist.
Oddly enough, it comes from those who are adopting that tactic of shutting down free speech by calling anyone with whom they disagree a racist or a fascist. Is out of the same political universe that relies on a spoils system of gender and race to hand out benefits from the government. So in a sense, it is antithetical to the Constitution or to our understandings of liberty to judge people by their race or their gender, to me. And at the same time, use it to silence dissent. I want
well, that's the that that is the that is everything now is filtered through the prism of race. It just unfortunately that's where we are. And again, you know, I saw a story the other day about how you know the Republicans voted for the in favor of contesting the election results right. of the Electoral College, something about how they were, you know, trying to disenfranchise, you know, they supported a resolution on Martin Luther King Day, or they praised Martin Luther King, and how dare they after they just voted to disenfranchise Black people in all these different states. And I'm like, really, is that really the everything has to be shoved into the through the race prism, and that's the angle that we need to take, because they were actually voting to disenfranchise. I mean, if you want to look at it from the, they were actually voting to disenfranchise everyone in all of those states and overturn the election results from all of those states. They did so because they thought there were irregularities, but the result was not just they were going to disenfranchise Black people.
Right.
And so, but that's the angle that is pushed. And it seems like everything we do these days is viewed through that prism. And it's unfortunate because you're right. It is in many ways, I think a lot of folks, it's antithetical to Martin Luther King Jr.'s vision. It's antithetical to the Constitution. And it prevents us from actually making progress on race. We're going in the wrong direction because that's all we're, I think it breeds a sort of just absolute resentment, and it makes it tough.
But it does have its advantages, Tom and Jeff.
Yeah.
But if you separate people by race and gender, so in other words, you're not thinking about their character or their ability, but their skin pigment and their genitalia. Then you can herd them easier into different pens for political purposes. And if you had a media that was responsible, this would be called out every day as race baiting or some in a negative fashion. But I don't. We started this talk 4 years ago about the media, Tom, and I see now that if you want to read a good media critic, go on Twitter. Yeah, you don't have to like it because then you might be accused of something. Go to on Twitter to @TomBevin, because Mr. Bevin is becoming quite the media critic.
It's @TomBevinRCP, by the way.
Oh, sorry. @TomBevinRCP. And I bring to your attention the letters TDS, which once stood for Trump Derangement Syndrome among conservatives. And now I think it should be redefined as Trump Dependency Syndrome, where I'm wondering about writing a column. I'm just trying to think this out loud with both of you guys. Rules for pundits who all they could write about is how Trump sucks or how Trump's voters suck and how they're racist and, you know, should be burned alive at the stake. What do they do now, Tom Bevin, Jeff Carlin? What do they do?
Well, they'll fill the void by praising anything Biden does or Kamala does or any one of many people who are somehow celebrities and rock stars and shoe icons. Yeah, you're right. I'm really curious, and we've joked about it in the newsroom that just on face value, You know, Trump not being a president slows a lot of our lives down because he's just worked at such a frenetic speed and just urgency all the time with what he was doing. This is going to be so much slower, and I feel like there are going to be a lot of hobbies being picked up by people in the media because they're not going to have someone to scream about or pull their hair about or, you know, run around the room on fire about. I'm curious, John, too. I don't know what this is going to be like.
Tom, any thoughts on this?
Well, listen, I do think Biden's going to be boring, and boring's not bad.
Right.
In fact, boring is might be what the public wants and needs at this moment. But I do think, and we can already see the media. One of the problems they got into after 8 years of covering Obama and just really sort of, you know, being asleep at the wheel in many respects, and just, you know, anything that he did was fantastic, and, you know, any
Nobel Prize.
And it was just like he would stand up there and say, you know, I just read about this Fast and Furious thing in the papers like you. I have no idea what's going on. I didn't hear about this IRS thing. I just learned about this, you know, and the press would just sit there and be like, yeah, sure. And then Trump comes along and literally everything he does is a five-alarm fire and an existential threat to the country. And they cover it that way to the point where we can't even discern anymore what's actually important and not important, because they're, you know, he'd tweet about, you know, the most insignificant thing, and it would become a constitutional crisis. And so the relentless negativity towards Trump is, you know, now he's gone. And the question is, you know, I think we've already seen that the press is going to sort of revert to this, at least in the short term. I mean, I've been sort of keeping track of the fluff pieces that have gone up, particularly, and they've most been about Kamala Harris and not Biden. They've been just astonishingly favorable coverage. And we'll see how long that honeymoon lasts. And I suspect it'll last for a while. And whether Biden's going to get any critical coverage, I don't know. I mean, it would be.
Aren't his arms extending across America?
Oh, CNN was just the worst in terms of debasing itself yesterday, from David Chalian to Jake Tapper to John King, Wolf Blitzer. There's
still some tinkering going on with the inaugural address, but his aides have made really clear it's not like he's trying to ignore or paper over either what happened at the Capitol 2 weeks ago or what we've been through throughout 4 years of the Trump presidency. And the contrast on display tonight was so stark. I mean, those lights that are just shooting out from the Lincoln Memorial along the reflecting pool, it's like almost extensions of Joe Biden's arms embracing America. It was a moment where the new president came to town and sort of convened the country in this moment of remembrance, outstretching his arms. And contrast that with that video you just saw of a disgraced president on his way out at his lowest point in his presidency at the very end here, by himself, fighting for his political movement to live on.
The contempt for Trump on the way out the door and the adulation of Joe Biden on the way in the door does not bode well for their sort of, you know, any restoration of their credibility, in my mind. It would be nice if the press could just play it straight and they could just report the news without fear or favor, you know, and this is what Carl Cannon and I talk about every day. This is what we try and do at Real Clear Politics. And it's hard because there is, we're just trying to deliver, you know, news and information to people and do it in an even-handed way. And the press has just sort of lost the plot when it comes to that. And because, quite frankly, their viewerships have become, on the left and the right, have become so partisan and so inflamed. You know, you see these folks talking about how the New York Times is, liberals think the New York Times is just, you know, a rag now. They can't, it's not progressive enough because they don't, you know, they don't, because of the way they frame a story on Donald Trump. I saw something the other day. And they said, how, you know, it's just a straight headline. It was a headline like Trump leaves after 4 years of a contentious administration. And you know, the progressive was like, how dare the New York Times normalize his behavior? You know, he was a, I mean, it's just like, really?
Right.
So that's the pressure that these news organizations are under. And unfortunately, for financial reasons and whatever, and I think because of the ideological composition of their newsrooms and their editorial boards now, they have moved in that direction. So it is really hard to just get sort of dispassionate. Everybody's so, I tweeted a silly joke yesterday, and I got so much, you know, blowback from it about, well, oh, you're a terrible human being and this, that. I'm like, I think part of the problem with this country right now is that we put too much of our lives are focused on and invested in politics. And it's become the national religion, and that's unfortunate. And we put too much stock in the presidency itself and the person of the presidency. And this is why I'm against all of the sort of general pomp and circumstance. Carl Cannon and I get into this all the time because he thinks it's important, all of the symbolism and all that. And I agree with that to a certain degree, but I would just as soon have State of the Union addresses delivered in writing, not go through that whole thing. All of that, even the inauguration to a certain degree, I think a lot of it is just, you know, ridiculous, in terms of, because we're promoting this idea of the presidency and this, and investing so much in an individual. And that's why we have a situation where the country is so warped now by politics that literally if Trump's reelected, it's the end of the republic. If Biden's elected, it's the, you know, end of the republic. It's like, we're going to be fine, people. And we were going to be fine, whether it was Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. We're going to be fine now with Joe Biden. We're going to be fine as a country. But because there's so much, because politics has become the national religion, it's had a really deleterious effect on our civic fabric. I mean, it's just, and civility in general.
Historically, I mean, the press over the decades has created the presidency as a god, as godlike, right? It's happened in many administrations, and it's just increased as the Washington press corps chatters and chatters about adding virtue, you know, talking about these people in terms of virtue rather than flaws. And this goes for both Republicans and Democrats. But I wonder now, with the next year's gridiron dinner, what kind of show tune parodies will the Washington press corps sing to the amusement of the Lord?
Right. Where it's sort of the, you know, the old guard is back, and we're going to return to the pre-Trump days of yes. I'll give you another example too, John, of what, you know, building these $2 billion temples to previous presidents like Barack Obama. And now, you know, Donald Trump's going to raise $2 billion. I mean, we should do it with all the presidential libraries. There should be one museum in Washington that houses exhibits for all the presidents, and that's it. And we don't have to go out and raise money and build these takeover, you know, sections of cities to build these monuments to presidents. I mean, it's ridiculous. They're just presidents.
I would like a presidential library of the books that the presidents read. Now, I would think, I don't know how many books Trump actually reads, but I would think Barack Obama's bookshelf would be all of his memoirs about himself and his biographies about himself.
They're taking over how many hundreds of acres of Chicago and building this monument to Barack Obama. And it's not just Obama. It's every past president.
Right.
It's like, this is insanity, and we should stop it because it contributes to this idea of this president worship. And you know, that has been a bad thing for the republic. The president is a co-equal branch of government. He is obviously an elected official. He is clearly the most powerful, you know, leader of the free world, and that's all fine, but let's not go to the point where where we invest so much in these individuals. And it's, you know, it happened with Obama. It happened with Trump. Maybe it won't happen as much with Joe Biden or in the future. Maybe that was an aberration, but it's disturbing because it leads to this mentality that the president is, as you said, godlike or some sort of, you know, deity that requires all of this adulation, which is, they're just presidents.
But then Jane Pauley, I saw, confronted her god, her goddess, Kamala Harris, on a network interview, and focused on her shoes.
Her shoes, right? And the, you know, the Biden's rescue dog is going to be the. I mean, it's just, it's all so silly. And the, you know, the play. I mean, it's nauseating, all of it, and it needs to stop. Unfortunately, it won't stop, but.
Don't stop. You know why?
I did find it humorous the other day when Justice Sotomayor mispronounced Kamala Harris's name while swearing her in, which, you know, is apparently what was at some point racist. If you couldn't, right. If you didn't pronounce her name right, this was
evidence of white supremacy.
I mean, it's all so silly. It's just ridiculous.
Tom, if people want to listen to you and Carl Cannon, I know that they can always go to the Tom Bevin show, which is on WLS at 8 o'clock.
Big 89, 8 p.m. Sunday nights.
8 p.m. Sunday nights.
Yep, and we do. Carl and I are doing a little video podcast on Tuesdays and Thursday mornings on Real Clear Politics called the RCP Takeaway. It's just a quick 5-minute hit of Carl and I talking about the day's events. And then we do a bigger sort of weekly wrap up podcast, the RCP Takeaway, which is audio only, which is on Fridays. So,
and these are free, just like the Chicago Way. You don't have to pay.
Absolutely.
For right. Because we're all about information.
That's right.
Tom Bevin. Stellar quarterback at Princeton.
Hold on. I got to correct the record, John. I was not a quarterback. I was a cornerback. I played defense. I was the smallest guy on the team.
Wait, I thought you came there as a quarterback.
I did play quarterback in high school, although we ran the Veer option, so I was more like a fourth running back than a actual, you know, pocket passer.
And you had face masks too, right? Not leather helmets or anything.
Yeah, we had face masks.
Former cornerback.
I don't want anyone to think that I'm, you know, that you're fluffing my resume and that I was a quarterback in college. The quarterback when I played at Princeton was Jason Garrett, who people have probably heard of. He was there a couple years ahead of me and played when I was there. And then our quarterback was a guy named Joel Sharp, who was actually about my size, but could throw the ball like you've never seen. So. Yeah, I was not a quarterback.
Wait, Jason Garrett, the former coach of the Dallas Cowboys?
Yeah, currently the offensive coordinator of the New York Giants.
So what was he like? I got to ask.
What was he like in college?
Was he as humorless as he looks on the sidelines?
Jason is a great guy, and he's a great leader. And he was that way in college as well. I mean, he was all about business and getting it done. So.
And so is Tom Bevin.
nice segue. That's a professional broadcasting right there.
Really? I'm absolutely. Trying not to look so ham-handed or sound so ham-handed. What a segue. What a transition.
What a transition.
Seamless.
Yes.
Seamless. Well, Tom, thanks for being here.
You got it.
And we had to ask about that fashion choice, surely a first for a vice president, the Converse Chuck Taylor sneakers, the Chucks.
I got to tell you, when you walked in, I checked out, is she wearing them? You're not wearing your Chucks today.
No.
What is the story?
It became a story. I've always worn Chucks.
What's the story? It's my casual
go-to. I, you know, grew up with Chucks. I just love them. They're comfortable.
I can attest. There is several closets full of them.
He's exaggerating.
For Tom Bevin, not a quarterback, only in high school, the cornerback at Princeton and founder of RealClearPolitics.com. And for Jeff Carlin, who, yes, makes pies and is executive producer of WGN Radio and is now, I think, getting into a Twitter spat with the right wing. Hey, leave Jeff Carlin alone. He's my friend.
Thanks, John.
And me, John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board, a lover of all things Spartacus, including that soliloquy about who resigns from politics and who doesn't. On the Chicago Way.